historic day for women in the United States.
After two decades, the FDA is removing its warning on drugs commonly used to treat menopause symptoms.
For Monday, November 10th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As President Trump deploys the National Guard to U.S. cities, some members of the Guard in Ohio are quietly expressing concern.
This is just not what any of us signed up for. And I just wonder, like, who's going to stand up to this, you know?
And first they came for the Oxford commas, and now the M-dash.
The grammar nerds are fighting again, but now AI is part of the controversy.
Don't allow technology to dictate what you are going to do with your generation.
Also, why is President Trump picking a fight with the BBC?
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Senate could vote later today on a bipartisan funding deal to end the government shutdown. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports the bill also needs to clear the House.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune says the new package extends spending levels through the end of January, but it also includes several full-year funding bills impacting key programs.
Year-long funding for SNAP, for WIC, for veterans, for essential farm programs, and for a number of other critical priorities will be met.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has advised lawmakers to return to Washington. And if the Senate acts quickly, the House could take up the deal as early as Wednesday. Most House and Senate Democratic leaders panned the deal because it does not address expiring health care subsidies. But Democrats who helped craft it say they did get a commitment for a Senate vote on health care legislation by mid-December. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
President Trump says he wants to issue what he's calling $2,000 dividends from tariff revenue. But as NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, the Treasury Secretary says there's no formal proposal yet.
President Trump on social media has twice in recent days suggested the payments for low and middle income people. However, on ABC's This Week on Sunday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the money may not take the form of payments, but could simply include tax cuts already passed into law.
It could be just the tax decreases that we are seeing on the president's agenda. You know, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security, deductibility of auto loans.
NPR asked the White House for any specifics on a plan. An official not authorized to speak on the record said, quote, "The administration is committed to putting this money to good use for the American people." Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Trump's ability to unilaterally levy tariffs is being challenged before the Supreme Court. He argues a ruling against him would devastate the economy. And a small group of National Guard members in Ohio is questioning President Trump's deployments to various U.S. cities. They spoke to NPR on the condition of anonymity. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
A few Guard members in Ohio started an encrypted group chat so they could talk about what was happening with the deployments and process them together.
I really went to like a dark place when they sent the troops to LA, eventually DC, and now like Chicago. Like, this is just not what any of us signed up for.
NPR met with three of them to talk about how they're feeling, what they would do if they were required to go on one of Trump's deployments, and if they had thought about ending their military careers. The Trump administration has said the deployments are necessary for law and order. Federal judges and local governments have disagreed. These three feel deeply uncomfortable with the possible direction they could be headed. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Ohio.
Major U.S. stock indexes closed up today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Major League Baseball says its authorized gambling operators will cap the amount that can be bet on individual pitches at $200 and exclude them from parlay-style bets. The move comes a day after two Cleveland Guardians pitchers were indicted and accused of rigging pitches at the behest of gamblers. MLB says the sportsbook operators that agreed to the limits represent more than 98% of the betting market in the country. The novel Flesh by David Sawloy has won this year's Booker Prize. The award goes to the best English language book published in the UK. As NPR's Andrew Limbong reports, prize judges said they had never read anything quite like it.
The novel follows a Hungarian man named Istvan from his teen years through old age. He's quiet, not the most emotive character, but that's all covering up a tumultuous life. The Booker Prize judges praised author David Soloy's sparse use of language. In a statement, Prize Chair Roddy Doyle said, quote, "Every word matters. The spaces between the words matter." Soloy is the first Hungarian-British author to win the award. He was shortlisted for the prize back in 2016 for his book All That Man Is. Flesh beat out five other novels for the win, including Katie Kitamura's Audition and Susan Choi's Flashlight. Winners of the Booker Prize receive 50,000 British pounds and, usually, a hefty bump in sales. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The black hat worn by Margaret Hamilton as the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz will be auctioned in December. A book signed by Judy Garland with autographs from the main cast and Toto's paw prints. Two versions of Dorothy's slippers will also be available in the sale by Heritage Auctions. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Weather tonight, chance of flurries, lows 22 to 29 degrees. South wind gusting up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. For more than two decades, the Food and Drug Administration has warned women about the potential risks of using estrogen to treat menopause symptoms. And that's because early studies showed an increased risk of endometrial cancer, cardiovascular disorders, and breast cancer. Well, those warnings are going away, and FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry led the way on that decision, and he's here with me in studio now. Thanks for coming by.
Great to be with you, Juana.
So, I mean, this black box warning that we're talking about, it's been in place on all estrogen treatments for more than two decades, since back in 2003. The timing, why remove it now?
Well, the fear machine did start in 2003 after a 2002 study that really hit the airwaves in the media with a big splash, mm-hmm. scaring women out of hormone replacement therapy in the postmenopausal setting. Up to one in four Americans were taking it. Women lived longer and felt better. But then it got deemed a carcinogen based on this study. Mm-hmm. Turns out when the study results were finally released, after the media announcement, there was no statistically significant increased risk of breast cancer. There was a lower rate of breast cancer in the estrogen-only group. And so it ends up being very nuanced, and the cardiovascular benefits are profound when hormone replacement therapy is started within 10 years of the onset of menopause. So there is some nuance here, yeah. But unfortunately, the fear machine has dominated the field, and women have been talked out of it. They've been denied or never offered hormone replacement therapy, despite the profound short-term and long-term benefits.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because there is a lot of nuance here. Just spell out plainly for us some of the benefits of hormone therapy as you see them.
Yeah, so starting hormone replacement therapy around the time of menopause not only can alleviate the short-term symptoms of menopause, that is, the hot flashes, night sweats, mm-hmm. mood swings, weight gain, difficulty sleeping, right. pain with sexual activity. There are 50-plus different symptoms, and every woman experiences them differently. Mm-hmm. You know, we were taught at medical school that some women have symptoms, but they're usually mild and they last just a couple years. Not true. 80-plus percent of women have symptoms. The average duration is 8 years. And for many women, it is severe. They are debilitating. The long-term benefits are remarkable and massively misunderstood. It reduces the risk of bone fractures later in life by 50 to 60%. That's a New England Journal study. Mm-hmm. It reduces cognitive decline by up to 64%. In one study, reduced the risk of Alzheimer's by 35%. And there are cardiovascular benefits when it started within 10 years of the onset of menopause.
Does it matter if a woman is taking a pill, which is systemic, or using a cream, which is a local treatment?
So there are pills, there are patches, there are creams and gels. cells.
Right.
And so all of these products had a black box warning from the FDA as a part of this pile-on, as a part of this bandwagon thinking in 2002, 2003. We are removing those and putting the nuances of the risks in the package insert. And the idea is to get better information in front of women.
Spell out some of these risks for us, because there are still risks associated with hormone replacement therapy. Is that right?
Yeah. When started more than 10 years after the onset of menopause, then you actually see some of these risks that are have been attributed to all hormone replacement therapy products. And that's probably because the body naturally is making estrogen. And the that increases nitric oxide. It keeps the blood vessels soft and the walls soft and healthy and dilated. And so when it started such that there's not a gap where your body is without it, then there are cardiovascular benefits where the reduction in heart disease has been noted to be 30 to 50%. That is a 30 to 50% reduction in heart disease. And in a study in Circulation 2 years ago, a 48% decline in heart attack deaths. And so that is because of the effect of estrogen. So if it started too late, the blood vessels are narrowing, and the theory is that they're hardening, and that aging and atherosclerosis can then result in a situation that is prone for a blood clot with hormone therapy.
Commissioner, are there women who should not be using hormone therapy?
Yes, many doctors do identify some contraindications. A woman with an underlying risk for blood clots, a woman with active breast cancer or past breast cancer, depending on the practice style of the physician. But the vast majority of women who go through menopause, which is about 2 million women a year, are great candidates for hormone replacement therapy. If a woman has a uterus, it's important for them to also take progesterone to reduce the risk of endometrial hyperplasia and possibly uterine cancer. But women who have been taking this for a long time have reported tremendous benefits, and they're talking about it on social media now. Yeah. So there is a bit of an awakening.
I do want to ask you about the process here, because in preparing to remove the black box warning, there's usually a formal, very detailed process. Things seem to play out differently this time. Tell us why.
Yeah, we're getting things done. In this administration at the FDA, we're getting things done. They were talking about removing or banning a food dye for 35 years before I got to the FDA. Within weeks, we took action to remove 9 petroleum-based food dyes from the food supply. That's all artificial dyes. In this case, we are responding to a petition that was filed in 2016. It was basically blown off. It was refiled in 2025. We held an expert panel. We didn't go through the long bureaucratic expensive process of bringing in conflicted experts to talk about a product. We brought in a range of diverse medical experts who passionately made the case for stopping the sphere machine by removing the black box warnings around cardiovascular disease, dementia, and breast cancer.
I mean, over the last several years in our society, I don't have to tell you this, but there has been this increasing recognition of the health challenges, the very real challenges that women face during menopause. And you and I were talking about the nuance in this conversation earlier. Do you worry at all that by removing this black box warning, that it might result in the pendulum tipping the other way, and there's now going to be an overuse of hormone therapy?
Well, tragically, over the last 23 years, 50 million women have been denied or talked out of hormone replacement therapy, in part because of the fear machine that it, hormone replacement therapy is a carcinogen. It causes breast cancer. We can argue whether or not the old type of progesterone used, called MPA, in that original study may have slightly increased the risk of breast cancer in women who took that MPA. But no clinical trial has ever found that it increases the risk of breast cancer mortality. And if it did, that harm would be far eclipsed by the profound cardiovascular benefits. You know, early on in the 1920s, Mayo Clinic researchers noted that young girls who had their ovaries removed went on to have heart disease in their 30s and 40s. Suggesting a profound cardiovascular protective effect. And so that's the nuanced conversation that people need to have.
We've been speaking with FDA Commissioner Dr. Marty McCarry, coming in to talk to us about the FDA's decision to remove black box warnings for estrogen treatments for menopause. Thank you so much for coming by our studios today.
Great to be with you, Juana.
President Trump has sued ABC News and CBS News, The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and now he is looking overseas at the BBC. The British public broadcaster aired a documentary last year with an edited version of Trump's speech to supporters on January 6, 2021. These were remarks before the Capitol riot. Two leaders of the BBC have resigned. NPR's David Folkenflik joins us now with more. Hi, David.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so President Trump is threatening to sue the BBC. Say more about what he's claiming here.
Well, he's pointing to this documentary that aired a couple weeks before last year's presidential elections, in which they took two parts of his famous speech on that now, notorious day, January 6, 2021, and compressed them together. They were two parts of speech that were over 50 minutes apart. And he's basically saying it made it seem as though he was urging people on to violence, even though there was an element they didn't quote where he said, you know, that they would take part in something that would be peacefully and patriotically making their voices be heard. And he's saying this is a form of defamation. He's demanding that the documentary be retracted, that the BBC apologize, and they pay him, you know, a sizable sum. And he says, don't do that. I'll sue for at least $1 billion in court in Florida is what he's threatening.
Okay. Well, how strong do you think his legal case is?
Well, look, NPR has a policy, and some other major mainstream news organizations do as well, where they say, well, you don't do these what are called internal edits on the president of the United States or somebody running for president in that way. You want to make sure there's transparency about rigorous transparency about how context is presented. In that letter of warning that the president's lawyers sent to the BBC, they talk about the fact that defenses that you can offer about certain kinds of opinion expressions being protected under the law, particularly in Florida law, that those don't apply here. But I think they actually do provide something of a roadmap for a potential defense that is not only if it's David's opinion, but, you know, if it's David's analysis, there's more expansive protections under case law for that. I think that's something the BBC could argue for a documentary approach of events that had happened, you know, several years before and been covered widely. You know, we'll see how a judge would respond to that if a lawsuit's filed.
Well, David, for those of us here in the U.S., explain why it does matter if the president sues the BBC.
Well, look, this is the playbook, right, where he goes after news organizations. You listed several he had sued. CBS and ABC settled lawsuits, making, you know, major payments off to Trump's interests. And in other ways, he's attempting to discredit news organizations by doing this. In the meantime, he's helping this ally of his, a far-right figure who's become in some ways prominent in the multi-party system in the UK, and that's Nigel Farage. And either way, if Trump prevails, if Trump does not prevail, it's a way to undercut the standing of the press. He can discredit it in the eyes of its supporters. He can point to something that genuinely the BBC screwed up, and there's no doubt of that. You had its CEO and its top editor step down. And even if he loses or this case is withdrawn or never filed, he gets to say, look, I'm pointing out how the mainstream press is out to get me, and you should believe what I have to say.
That is NPR's David Folkenflik. Thank you, David.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer. Nice catch. Now it's time for your daily dose of phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, November 10th, in the year 2004, Harry Hutchins remarks that he has spotted some yellow-rumped warblers still in the area. The yellow-rumped warbler is an interesting bird. It's one of the first ones to come back in the springtime. I usually watch for them as the maples begin to flower. The yellow-rumped warblers will be showing up to hawk insects. And now, in the fall, they are able to prolong their stay in northern Minnesota by switching from insects as a food source to fruit. And this time of year, they will be eating whatever sorts of fruits they can find. and it will help them to survive as they get ready to migrate. For the most part, by this time in November, most of them have headed south, but there are always a few that are kind of dragging up the back end of the herd, and these guys were that group, eating a few fruits before they head down south to a better environment for birds.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. An encrypted group chat has become a place for some National Guard members in Ohio to work out how they're feeling as they have watched President Trump deploy troops to several U.S. cities. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf heard about that chat and traveled to Ohio to meet some of the members.
Shortly after Trump took office earlier this year, Jay started feeling very unnerved about the president's executive orders surrounding the military.
I got with some people that I knew were like-minded, and then they knew some other people, and we decided that a chat, like a place that we could express these things with people that are feeling the same way.
We're only identifying Jay and other National Guard members in this piece by their first initials because they fear retribution for speaking to the media. Jay went to a member of his unit in Ohio, and brought up the idea of an encrypted chat.
We're on there every day, sharing information, news articles, whatever.
And it's not even like necessarily expressing opinions or anything. It's just expressing like questions about things that come out, right?
We needed something to be able to talk to each other.
That's C, also a member of the same unit, also in the chat. The four of us are sitting in a tiny study room in a public library in suburban Ohio.
Did it just kind of start growing a little bit? Like, how many people are in it now? Is it like 10 or 12?
12.
And was there like a vibe shift at some point where people were kind of looking at what was happening with these National Guard deployments and saying like, wait a minute?
I really went to like a dark place when they sent the troops to LA and then eventually DC and now like Chicago. Like every time I see that, it's just like, this is just not what any of us signed up for. And I just wonder like, who's gonna stand up to this, you know?
All three of these Guard members have served for years, even decades. The concern about being sent out on one of these deployments is legitimate. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine has said he will send troops to other states. There are around 150 from Ohio in D.C. right now. That voluntary directive has come to this unit. None of these three have taken it. They point out it's hurricane season, usually when National Guard members are thinking about deployments to help in the aftermath of a storm.
Those are the moments a lot of members of the National Guard live for. Like, they're able to go into these other areas and maybe provide a little bit of assistance during these tough times. But instead, we have D.C. come across our desk like, anybody want to go to this? And no one raises their hand. Well, what exactly are we going to be doing? Like, are we going to have leave? And those answers aren't very clear.
They say they've tried to raise these questions further up the chain of command.
We were concerned. We asked the question. We got a kind of a poo-poo, I will say. And for me, it's just, I don't let them off the hook.
In response to NPR, Pentagon Press Secretary Kingsley Wilson said that the Pentagon is confident in the National Guard and, quote, their collective ability to carry out any and all orders by President Trump. In D.C., where more than 2,000 troops have been deployed for months, Guard members are largely patrolling the streets. But Jay says that bothers him.
People who don't see people in uniform every day, you send 50 of them out to walk their street, it's going to send a message, you know, even if they're not doing anything.
They also say it's the continued and increasingly hostile rhetoric around the deployments that has them worried. In cities like Portland or Chicago, the Trump administration has said troops are needed to quell unrest and protect federal immigration facilities and officers. Federal judges and local governments have disagreed. Those deployments are tied up in court. And the administration has publicly talked about using the National Guard to help with immigration enforcement, something broadly illegal under U.S. law. Threatening to send troops to Chicago, the president famously posted an Apocalypse Now-style AI-generated picture, which said, quote, "I love the smell of deportations in the morning." I bring that up. And I wonder, you know, I see you all kind of taking a deep breath. That must have gone in the group chat.
Like, we're just like, is this real? That's the question. It's so unbelievable sometimes that we have to, like, get assurance. Is this really happening?
For that to come from, like, the epicenter of the military, it ripples out. You see that, and it frees up other people, and they start to quote the same things because it's coming from the top.
I ask them if they've thought about leaving, ending their military careers.
I would get out if I could. The only reason I want to finish my current contract is just because I feel like there's weight to what I do and say right now, and I just want to use that to do some good.
If for some reason this became so unbearable that I was like, I have to get out of the military, then you are a cog in a machine. So I get taken out, someone else is just going to be put in. I like the idea that I can make a difference within my 6 feet. And if there's enough of us in a military organization, I think that's enough to make a bigger difference than what we realize.
So to be clear, not every engagement I've ever done, every deployment I ever have been on, I've agreed with, but that's what the apolitical military is, right? You go when you're asked and you're called when it's legal and lawful. But right now, how I'm feeling? Lots of therapy has taken me to the point where at least I can be okay if I have to say goodbye. That sucks. And the things on my mind are, what is my line that I won't cross? What am I prepared to give up? Is this tarnishing my service? Is it undoing everything I thought I was fighting for? Because I spent a lot of time being really proud of my military career and my service, just to watch it possibly go up in flames.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because I can imagine that's really hard, and it seems like maybe you don't even really have the answers to those questions yet.
I know what my line is. I am a cog, right? Like, somebody else can replace me, so that's why I'm sitting here. I'm okay if I have to go, if I'm asked to go, I have a way, but right now I gotta stay and do the good I can, because the person behind me might not.
Conversations like this aren't just happening here in this public library in Ohio. They're happening all over the country.
In the military culture, it's really easy to feel like if you have questions or dissent that you're the only person who thinks that.
Brittany Ramos de Barros is the director of About Face, a nonpartisan nonprofit made up of current service members and post-9/11 veterans to be a resource for those who might be questioning their deployments. The group has started an information campaign specifically targeting members of the National Guard around the country, flyers, posters, billboards, encouraging them to reach out if they're having doubts. She says more than 100 have so far.
We take very seriously making sure that people do understand what they could be facing if they follow their conscience. But the thing we also help people think through is, what is the cost of not following your conscience? Because as Iraq and Afghanistan vets in particular, many of us are living with that cost every day.
De Barros is a combat veteran who deployed to Afghanistan. She says she believes the patrols in U.S. cities are sending a message.
In Afghanistan, we used to regularly carry out what are called presence patrols, where there was no purpose or mission other than to be present in the space and normalizing that we were there and letting people know, oh, if you act up, we're here and we're watching.
NPR reached out to the White House for comment on this story. Spokesperson Abigail Jackson asserted that Trump's deployments are lawful and necessary to, quote, protect federal assets and personnel following violent left-wing riots. Back in that library room in Ohio, as we're wrapping up our conversation, I ask all three Guard members if they have a final thought.
I swore an oath to the Constitution, not a person. And I just feel like, I don't know, I just really, really implore my peers and everybody outside looking in to just think about that.
Because if the moment that we stop asking the questions, then everything falls on their face.
There's troops all across the military with their own kind of feelings, reasons for do I or don't I, you know. So I hope that those people can all connect.
One way to do that, start a group chat. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Ohio.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. And we receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at Dale'sAutoBodyInc.com. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, Canadians will pause for Remembrance Day to honor those in the military who died serving their country, as well as those still serving. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, special ceremonies over the weekend honored Indigenous members of Canada's military.
It's Indigenous Veterans Day and has been commemorated since 1994. Indigenous members of Canada's military shared their stories at ceremonies across the country. In Ottawa, Defense Minister David McGuinty had this message for them.
Throughout our history, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis members have served with exceptional bravery and distinction in the Canadian Armed Forces. They have fought, endured, and sacrificed in our name. From Vimy to Dieppe, from Korea to Afghanistan, Indigenous service members have demonstrated extraordinary skill, courage, and devotion to duty.
Indigenous Veterans Day came about because many of those veterans were not given the same benefits as their non-Indigenous peers. Ray Deer is the president of Quebec's only First Nations-operated Canadian Legion. He says people need to know about the contributions made by Indigenous members of the military.
I think by joining the military, it gives us a voice. It gives us a voice that can be heard amongst the Canadians and the Americans because they know we served alongside them. Without doing that, without serving alongside them, you're more than invisible. We're invisible as it is, but it would be worse off if we didn't participate.
Other Indigenous veterans say they gained respect from military colleagues for their character and their ability as soldiers. But some say the camaraderie vanished when the fighting was over and there was a return to Canada. The federal government says more than 4,000 Indigenous people served in the military in the First World War and 3,000 served in the Second World War. Recently, the government acknowledged the unfair treatment of Indigenous soldiers, where many thought their rights and standing would improve when they returned home. But as efforts towards reconciliation gained momentum in recent years, there was more effort to recognize Indigenous veterans and their contributions. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A tribal school district in northeast Wisconsin says the government shutdown has impacted federal funding it relies on for salaries, supplies, and student programming. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
The Menominee Indian School District is one of about 20 school districts in Wisconsin that receive impact aid funding. The program provides support for public schools on federal lands. Superintendent Marcus Denny says their district has limited access to local tax dollars due to a small taxable land base, so program funds cover about 40% of their budget, but payments haven't gone out because of the government shutdown.
So that's impacted our budget big time. We've had to move around a lot of funds from our general fund. We had to seek a line of credit with our bank to help meet operational needs. It's impacted us heavily.
The district serves about 1,000 students, and Denny says many of them come from high poverty backgrounds. He says food assistance cuts due to the government shutdown are also having a broader community impact, as many students don't have adequate access to food at home. Denny notes community organizations and the tribal government are working together to support local families by stocking food pantries and soliciting donations to send home with students. Denny says the Impact Aid Office has been in frequent communication with districts throughout the government shutdown and has informed them that payments will be processed once operations resume, despite concerns about resources becoming increasingly scarce should the shutdown continue. Denny says he has confidence in his community.
The Menominee people and Indigenous people in general are very resilient, and we've faced challenges for years with the government, and this is just another bump in the road for us, and we just continue to do what's best for our kids and our community.
I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From comics to games to film and TV, Indigipop X is Native American popular culture. Everyone is welcome this weekend at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Info at indigipopx.com who support this show.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto needs at amerind.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Senate is expected to vote on a spending package as early as today that would end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Late last night, a handful of Senate Democrats broke with their party and sided with Republicans on a bill that would fund the government through January. For more, we're going to turn now to Republican strategist Mike Ricci. He's worked with several congressional Republicans, including former Speaker John Boehner during the government shutdowns in 2013, 2018, and 2019. Mike Ricci, welcome to All Things Considered.
Good evening.
Good evening. Okay, so we love to say government shutdowns feel like a movie that just keeps on replaying. Has this shutdown felt any different to you?
Well, to your point, you go into these trying to have a sense of how they'll end, and your job is to kind of know kind of how to get to the ending, the denouement, if you will. And this shutdown, there just never was a sense of, you know, how are they going to land this plane? How are they going to stick this landing? And, you know, instead we got kind of this underwhelming, exit last night and tonight. They're kind of rushing out of there. So it's hard to believe that after such a long ordeal that it's happening so abruptly.
I was going to ask you what you thought of the deal. You find it totally underwhelming?
Well, I think, again, you know, perception is destiny for these leaders. And so you want, if you're going to go into a big fight like this, you want to have a sense of, you know, there's a lot of showmanship involved, and you want to sell the deal, and you want to, you know, you can win by losing and saying, look, we got more than we thought we could, than Republicans thought we could. And, you know, instead it was kind of a handful of Senate Democrats, nobody in leadership really, at a press conference last night, instead of, you know, leadership's Chuck Schumer especially, kind of dictating the pace of things. And again, it just very much underwhelming after such a long ordeal.
Yeah, well, let's talk about blame, because this shutdown, it's another example of how both parties blame each other for some problem. Who do you see getting the blame here? Because, yes, Republicans are in control of Congress, but, you know, here's this small faction of Democrats breaking away from their leaders to make this deal. Who do you think is going to be held responsible for the last several weeks?
Well, I think I'm going to punt a bit and say that we're kind of in a runoff, if you will, here to see what happens in the next 30 days or so with the health care subsidies. Mm-hmm. And if Democrats can figure out, because they said they would get a vote on these subsidies. And so if everything is about the cost of living now, as we saw in last week's elections, and you can frame the next 30 days around health care and around the cost of living going into the holidays, then Democrats have a chance to shift the blame back to President Trump and Republicans. But if this becomes about the division among Democrats that we're seeing play out on social media once again, as we have time and again, then, you know, Democrats will miss an opportunity here to really keep Republicans on the defensive. So, you know, I think there's going to be a bit of an overtime period here, if you will, to really see how it lands. And, you know, obviously we didn't see the worst of it with SNAP benefits or even with, air travel.
But, yeah, with Thanksgiving,
you know, that
coming,
probably would have been where the blame really would have set in, but perhaps they've cut that off here at the pass.
Well, I'm asking about blame because blame obviously most matters when there's an election. How much do you think voters will remember this fight a year from now when they're voting in the midterms?
Very little. I was a part of the shutdown in October 2013, and I thought it was going to be the end of everything. And we won the next election 13 months later. You know, we could, if you could point out things that happened 2-3 months ago that you forgot almost happened. So I think very little, but it does affect the dynamics of how these parties, get together, how they have a coherent message for the midterms. You know, a lot of Democrats are going to be having conversations in the next few days of whether Chuck Schumer should still be, one of their leaders. And that obviously takes away time and energy from fighting in the election.
Well, last question for you. I mean, obviously, we're seeing fault lines among Democrats, at least in the Senate. What kind of tensions are you seeing among Republicans right now?
So, you know, Speaker Mike Johnson took the extraordinary step of keeping the House away now for, I think, almost 50 days. And bringing them back, that'll be a bit of a there'll be a bit of a venting and a bit of decompression there. And we'll see how much Republicans resented that and how much they're able to get back together on the same page. Again, Democrats kind of fighting with each other probably convinces them that they got a good win here. And maybe that's a way to move past last week's elections. But those first 24, 48 hours when the House comes back, you're going to want to watch closely what members are saying and how much theatrics there are towards the speaker there.
That is Republican strategist Mike Ricci. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're reading something that was generated by AI, there may be signs a chatbot might delve into or conceptualize or leverage a topic or overuse adjectives and transition words that humans rarely actually write. And it might set them off with the elongated hyphen known as the M dash.
It's like it's the only piece of punctuation they've learned other than a period. It's used way too often and often in nonsensical ways.
Susan Lovett is a writing story coach. At a previous job, her coworkers called her the M-dash queen.
That dramatic pause, it allows a voice to breathe on the page.
It is a versatile punctuation mark. I use it a lot. It can act like a comma or a colon or a parentheses. It can help emphasize a point or expand an idea. But earlier this year, it came to the attention of internet linguists that AI appears to be deploying it way too much.
I know you used AI to write this. No, I didn't. What are you talking about? I can tell from all the dashes.
TikTok user at Memes for Writers explained the phenomenon. Reddit users have asked, should I stop using the M dash so folks don't think I used AI? And, well, some people have concluded yes.
So basically, public service announcement, take out
check
the hyphen.
It.
At least that's the advice of Lux Gen, a fashion and lifestyle podcast aimed at Gen Z listeners. It brought the term the ChatGPT hyphen into the mainstream.
And that prompted months and months of think pieces, newsletters, blog posts, and LinkedIn missives, because that guidance just does not sit right with some writers like Susan Lovett.
It doesn't need to be that way if it's used properly.
For Lovett and others in the backlash, to the M-dash, the solution isn't to avoid it, it's to reclaim the punctuation mark, to stand up for its correct use.
To my Gen Z or Gen Alpha compatriots, I would say don't allow technology to dictate what you are going to do with your generation.
Carla Zanoni is a journalist and media consultant. Her Substack is literally called the M-dash. Zanoni, who also writes poetry, points out that this is far from the first time that this punctuation mark has been scrutinized.
Emily Dickinson is like the OG M-dash user. And has historically, by scholars, by novices, been found confusing and confounding for her use of the M-dash.
Though Emily Dickinson was unknown in her lifetime, her work makes heavy use of long dashes, and today she's considered a great poet. Carla Zanoni said she could set an example for all of us. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. And we receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at HUGHydronics.com. VFW Post 1720 in Grand Rapids invites the community to honor veterans tomorrow. Doors open at 11 a.m. with a lunch and program at noon. And don't forget our question of the week. Tell us about your home ec and shop class projects. Text 218-326-1234.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the state and Leech Lake band members sign a cannabis compact. Then, we try to figure out why we're seeing an increase in hate-motivated attacks in our state. And a pilot project for same-day driver's licenses that didn't pan out. I'm Chantel Sains. Governor Tim Walz and the Office of Cannabis Management have signed a new tribal state compact with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. The agreement outlines how the state and tribe will ensure public health and safety in Minnesota's adult-use cannabis industry while honoring tribal sovereignty. Officials say the partnership will strengthen trust in the state's regulated market. The Leech Lake Band joins four other tribal nations that have reached similar agreements with the state. Next, political and hate-motivated attacks have drawn headlines across Minnesota this year. But are they a growing threat, or has increased political polarization changed people's perception? Zan Holston has more.
In recent months, vandals sprayed a South Minneapolis synagogue with pro-Hamas graffiti. Someone hit Senator Omar Fateh's mayoral race headquarters with anti-Muslim messaging. A man, since arrested, allegedly firebombed an LGBTQ-friendly ice cream parlor twice. And St. Paul police charged a man for allegedly tearing down pride flags and damaging businesses all summer. Those recent events, coming on the heels of the assassination of Senator Melissa Hortman and the shooting at Annunciation School, have fueled the sense that political and hate-motivated violence is on the rise, even if the data isn't always necessarily so clear.
Certainly it makes people feel much less safe in those settings if they feel like they are being targeted or at risk.
Dr. Michelle Phelps is a sociology professor at the University of Minnesota. She said that ambiguity makes it hard to track trends or assign motives.
It's really hard definitionally to figure out exactly what counts as political violence versus other kinds of violence.
Still, every new incident changes how people feel about safety in their neighborhoods, workplaces, or places of worship. And when fear rises, Phelps said, communities often respond by adding barriers.
People's reactions to those moments of insecurities are often to tighten up on security measures.
That might look like more police at schools in response to shootings or armed security at places of worship, but that can also increase feelings of anxiety and separateness. Phelps said that approach misses the deeper question. How do you reach people before they become isolated or radicalized?
The answer is often not, okay, how do we reach out to people? How do we build community? And that is always going to be a kind of losing proposition in terms of long-term safety.
Respect for civil discourse, for pluralism. We've lost that.
Monica Harris leads the nonprofit FAIR, the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism, a self-described centrist organization working to reduce political polarization through education and dialogue. She said these tensions aren't new, but the volume has gone up.
Hate crimes, polarization, and intolerance have been in this country I'm not going to say it's endemic, but we're no strangers to this.
Harris points to constant political and cultural fights online, from partisan rhetoric to identity-driven social media debates, is fueling a sense of division and threat.
That actually fuels a lot of these identity-motivated attacks because it creates a cycle of fear, of division.
For Harris, reversing these cycles won't come from following the lead of politicians, but from finding ways to truly communicate with people who aren't the same as us and who we might disagree with.
It's not going to come from the leadership because there are too many people whose platforms and whose campaigns thrive on division.
She said this has to start in schools and neighborhood conversations where people actually listen to each other as a community and not enemies in a culture war.
The change we want has got to come from below and trickle upwards.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The state is phasing out a pilot program that let Minnesotans receive same-day driver's licenses and ID cards. The Lakeville License Center, located 20 miles south of Minneapolis, was one of two locations testing on-the-spot printing, but differences in card quality and appearance caused problems for some customers. The Division of Driver and Vehicle Services has recommended ending the program, though same-day service will continue in Moorhead for now. All same-day cards will remain valid until they expire.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump has announced that no U.S. official will be attending the G20 summit in South Africa this month, citing what he called, quote, human rights abuses against white minority Afrikaners. Vice President J.D. Vance had been due to attend in Trump's place. But as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg, some prominent Afrikaners are urging the U.S. to reconsider, saying the U.S. should not boycott the first G20 ever to be held on African soil.
Trump has been relentlessly critical of South Africa since his return to office. He ambushed the country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, during a White House visit in May, falsely claiming the South African government was seizing white-owned land. He cut aid to South Africa, repeated debunked far-right claims about a white genocide there, and as a result, prioritized Afrikaners for refugee status in the U.S. Now, he says, one of Africa's richest democracies shouldn't be hosting the G20, posting on Truth Social over the weekend that Afrikaners are, quote, being killed and slaughtered and their land and farms are being illegally confiscated. White Afrikaner journalist and author Max Dupria says that Trump's assertions are false.
There's absolutely no persecution of anyone based on race. Our constitution has ironclad protection of every citizen's human rights.
Dupria is one of dozens of Afrikaner intellectuals who recently signed an open letter refuting the U.S. administration's claims. He told NPR they rejected what he called the abuse of their ethnic identity to, quote, further the MAGA movement's interests.
Not a single square inch of white-owned land has been confiscated since we became a democracy in 1994. Please stop lying about us and using us as pawns.
Black people are by far the biggest victims of violent crime in South Africa, and white people still own the majority of commercial farmland. Ironically, those white commercial farmers would be among the worst affected by Trump's 30% tariffs on South African goods. Christo van der Rieder, head of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, agrees Trump's allegations are baseless.
These claims are simply untrue, dangerous, and not supported by any credible data.
Van der Rieder said it would also be very negative for the U.S. and its business interests if it stayed away from the G20 summit taking place at the end of next week.
We are ready. Are you?
South Africa's been promoting its big event all year.
Welcome you to South Africa.
The South African government has released a measured statement in response to Trump's announcement, once again denying his accusations. Crispin Piri, spokesman for the Department of International Relations, remained positive.
We really think that this is going to be one of the most significant G20s to date, albeit without the attendance of the USA.
European countries and China have backed South Africa's hosting of the summit. Its theme, solidarity, equality and sustainability, has drawn criticism from the US State Department. But despite what the South Africans say, the absence of the G20's largest economy, the US, will be impossible to ignore. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day, which got us thinking about one of our favorite entries in NPR's College Podcast Challenge. It was a love letter of sorts from a big sister. When her little sister Jules shipped off to the U.S. Army a couple years ago, Trinity Chase Hunt tried to keep in touch. Back then, Trinity was a senior at the University of Delaware, and she kept calling and writing her sister. And then she made a podcast about it. It's called Dear Little Sister.
It is no small feat to watch from afar as your 18-year-old sister goes through one of the most difficult challenges that anyone could ever experience. Jewel has always been independent, but joining the army was truly something that she had to go through all on her own. My mom, my youngest sister Nadia, and I had to sit by and do nothing while Jewel transformed from an everyday civilian into a United States soldier. Throughout it all, I wrote Jewel letters to keep her updated on my life and let her know how I was feeling. Dear little sister, Sundays are like torture. I spend the entire day hoping that you'll call. Once 3 p.m. rolls around, my heart starts racing and I can't focus on anything else. Mommy has been reading articles that say sometimes trainees get in trouble and won't be allowed to call home. It's honestly starting to get to me. I think someone needs to take her phone away because she's just been Googling and researching everything. Sometimes she would call and she would be crying. I didn't know how to comfort her. She told us before she left that she never wanted to hear that we missed her because she thought that it would distract her or make her sad. And so instead, she just wanted us to give her distraction from the military life.
Cardi B and Megan have a new song.
Cardi B and who?
Megan Thee Stallion have a new song.
Are you serious?
Here, wait, let me play you a snippet.
It was different, though. Sometimes we would make a joke and Jewel wouldn't catch on, or she wouldn't care about things she used to care about. It was like she was stuck in soldier mode and we couldn't relate to each other like we used to. Sometimes our phone calls would be disconnected in the middle of a story.
Like, mm-hmm. I can't do this again.
Yeah. Okay.
The phone's breaking up, Mom.
Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear us?
Sometimes the phone calls would be interrupted by the entrance of a drill sergeant.
Here, I gotta go.
Love you, bye.
Love you, bye.
I love you so much.
Dear little sister, I've never been completely into politics. I care and I vote, but it's never been in the forefront of my mind. It even recently occurred to me that when I vote in the next presidential election, I'm voting for my sister's boss. It's weird and strange because before Jewel enlisted in the army, I didn't really consider the fact that when they talk about the U.S. military as one whole group, as a union, as a force, there are individuals that make up that force, and there are individual families that are affected by the choices that our government and our politicians make. So all of the letters and all of the phone calls led up to Jewel's graduation from Army Basic Training. My family flew all the way to Oklahoma to see our new soldier. I remember seeing all of the graduates come marching out and searching their faces for my sisters. They all looked the same. They had the same expression, the same posture. They moved as one. At one point, I briefly glanced at a familiar face. She looked so different, I almost didn't recognize her. But that was Jewel, and she was a soldier. My youngest sister was the first one to cry as my whole family gathered and embraced Jewel. All around us, soldiers who were so stoic minutes ago were all clinging onto their families, crying and rejoicing. I saw grown men break down as their children ran up to them. I saw a veteran father cry with pride when he saw his daughter in her soldier's uniform. This is who we are sending to war. This is who is fighting for us. So, dear little sister, when you listen to this, proud is an understatement. You've inspired everyone who knows you. You went through something distinct and indescribable. I know I couldn't have done it, but I thank you. And I thank your peers. And I love you so much.
That story was from NPR's College Podcast Challenge. And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From EBSCO, committed to providing perpetual access to print and digital books for libraries and the communities they serve. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co-House on November 20th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at ThirdCoastChamberCollective.com. The KAXE News Team has put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You'll find hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Go to KAXE.org. If you have something to add, email news at KAXE.org.